Someone has left me the master key. It opens all the doors. That happens to be the subject of today's discussion. The master. I've been listening to these noises out there since last night, and had a lot of thoughts about them and what they mean and what they are, and asked Claudia about it, and we discussed it. And then I opened up a newspaper that I bought Thursday in Paris and had not read, and opened it to an article in which the person was discussing a ceremony at the end of Easter week, of Holy Week, which is called the Ténèbres or something. I don't know if any of you know it. It's traditional at the end of the Easter week. It's at night, and or at the end of the day, and it's special because there is no ceremony really. There is no music. There are 15 candles on the altar. Apparently the priest says a few things, and as the darkness falls inside the church and outside, the candles are put out one after another until it's total darkness. At that point, when it's finished, the ceremony, by some miracle, there is one candle hidden somewhere that is brought out, and there is a huge noise that is made at the door of the church. And this article, the man, it's a modern story he's telling. He said in his church, they use the covers of garbage cans, banging them together, making a loud noise. He didn't know what the origin was. He asked a priest, and the priest said that originally, in ancient times, the candle and the loud noise were to help the people find their way out of the church because it was dark. He asked another priest, and another priest said the loud noise was symbolizing the fact that the disciples betrayed Christ. And a reminder that in the darkness, no light, the loud noise is a reminder of the fact that we are alone. I have no idea what any of this symbolism means, but that's what I found. So I sat with this and wondered about the loud noise that continued. It's no longer dark. It's not the end of the week anymore. According to the Christian belief and the Christian calendar, today Christ is arisen. So the Christians aren't alone, and they're not in the darkness, and they're not lost. But the noise continues. So probably there's some other meaning to this noise that we don't know about. Or maybe someone does. No?
Yes,
no?
It's for announcing the... Each priest has a particular group that goes home by home, saying that Christ is
reborn.
Mm-hmm. And when the group is coming to the a little village or a group of house, they send them this kind of song.
Yeah, that's what Claudius told me.
Yes. Yeah. It continues all day long because there are groups, they are along the day doing that. When they finish, the sound will stop.
They have to do all the houses.
All the houses.
They will do it tomorrow also. Because only the rich, they did the festivities on Saturday, on Sunday, and the who work for the rich had to do the festivities on Monday.
The original reason that... Okay.
And so also there is a story that it is to frighten the bad spirits, to make a lot of noise, and also the bad things, but that is in many cultures.
And they all, these all stories, they all kind of come together, right? They're announcing something, or they're making, drawing our attention to something else, or awakening us to something.
There is a particular sound in the Thursday that it's make at night at Braga. It's a very frightening sound that is reminding the souls that they must be regrets for all things and become prepared for the rise of Christ in Sunday.
And that probably corresponds to the Tenebre. In any case, these are all some sort of signal to us, right? And we do this here with the bell. We ring a bell. Or we clap the pieces of wood. We use sounds for many different reasons to draw our attention. Or as we say at night, awaken. So the question that was put to me recently was what is the master? What is a master? And this ties in with the story of the sounds. There, as soon as we ask the question of what is a master, we have the question of what is a disciple, what is a student, because there's not one without the other. In fact, if there is no student, there is no master. It's a interdependent relationship, as is everything. As is all of life. I think, however, the question is, when it's asked as it was asked, it's more, okay, well, what makes one a master and one a student? What makes this person a master? And it's a common question, and it's an important question to ask. I'm afraid that I can't really give you an answer. that will satisfy you in a way that your minds may be addressing the question. But I can offer some elements to further your experience, perhaps, to help you experience something deeper and to question what is a student and what is a master for yourself. Because ultimately that's all I do, is raise questions and teach you how to ask questions, more or less. My own experience, when I met the woman who would become my teacher, my master, I didn't know that I was going to meet her, but I knew that I was going to meet someone who would tell me about Zen meditation. I knew that, but I didn't know what Zen meditation was. And I didn't know who she was. Through a mutual acquaintance, we were put in touch with one another. And I met her not in a context like this, but in her apartment, in her ordinary living situation. And whatever else happened after, whatever else arrived so that we are sitting here now, and what happened in the moment when I met her resulted in this, but whatever else. In that first moment when I met her, everything was done. I didn't know that, but what I did experience was simplicity. I had never seen anyone so simple in all of my life. Not simple in any way that we can identify. She was dressed just like anyone else. She looked just like anyone else. So there was nothing extraordinary about her simplicity. And she spoke just very ordinary. And we were just in an ordinary apartment on a Thursday afternoon in Paris in July. Nothing exceptional. Which was what made it so exceptional. We say also that when the student is ready, the master appears. It was the exact perfect moment. I didn't know I was seeking a master. She didn't know that a student was arriving, although she probably knew more than I did, because she had been there. Which put her in the position of master. She had been there before. I had not. I was in the position of seeking. I was looking for something which I couldn't really identify. I wanted to know more about meditation. But it wasn't, I didn't care about Zen. And I didn't really care about meditation. But I cared about what I experienced when I was practicing meditation. And if there was some other way to experience that, I was open to that. And I didn't really care about her. To be honest, I just cared about, I wanted to know. I wanted to know more. Which is what, it's the exact description of a disciple, of a student, of a seeker. And you can all understand that. when you want to know something, when you want to learn, when you're looking for something. If I had had a precise idea of what I was seeking, I would not have found it. If I had been fixed on something specific, I would not have found what I found. So, I met my teacher, and of course, from then on, our relationship, we've developed a relationship, and there were things about her that I liked, things about her that I loved, things about her that I didn't like, things about her that I really didn't like. All sorts of other things happened. But none of that mattered. None of that matters, because that's not what it's about. And the initial simplicity is what matters. This happens to be my chronology. Everyone has their own experiences with finding a practice, finding a teacher, in any activity in life. Everyone has their own trajectory, I'll say. Which have some common factors. They don't necessarily happen in the same order, let's say. Sometimes people are attracted to the human aspects of a teacher, and they fall in love with this person. Later they realize that it wasn't really the person that they were in love with, that what they were looking for was something else. Some people meet someone and they hate that person, but they're drawn to him or her. And that eventually becomes not so important. It's not so much about the personal aspects, that there's something impersonal that is happening. One definition of the meeting of student and teacher is two doors opening on empty space, which is what happens when we meet in an interview, in the interviews that I do. We both come with no idea. We don't know what will happen there. We both open our doors and we see what happens, what comes up. That's why I say, when the initial simplicity, everything was done in that moment. Of course, there was a lot that transpired after. That was many, many, many years ago. So, what happens in our Zen tradition, a teacher, a master, acknowledges another, acknowledges a student who he or she says can do this for someone else, can be a vehicle, can be a container for these teachings. It doesn't mean that the personal aspects, excuse me, of this person are extraordinary or exceptional, perfect, without flaw. It just means that the vehicle, this manifestation, is available to convey the impersonal, to convey, to open the doors. And the reason that the teacher recognizes that, that this vehicle is available to open the doors is because that person has realized that about him or herself. So the teacher is not giving anything, is not, we say transmitting, but is not really transmitting anything, because it's the person who realizes it, him or herself. And then the person sits here and says to other people, you have to realize it yourself. Because this person knows that that's how it works, from personal experience. So, from personal experience, this person has experienced the impersonal. It doesn't mean that this person doesn't have a bad knee. You know, I have a problem with my knee at the moment. I'm not perfect. Or that this person forgets. Last night I forgot to put on my rocker suit, and I came and sat without it. I could blame my assistant and say, you should have told me I didn't have it. What is this? Yeah. Okay. So we'll have a little parentheses and I'll explain what this is. Which is not really a parenthesis, it's part of the story. The symbolism is that it's a reduced version of the original disciples of the Buddha made out their own clothing. And they made it out of bits of cloth that had been given to them by other people. They had no possessions. They had nothing. And so they sewed together these little pieces. Maybe they were bigger, but they sewed it together and wore this robe that they made from pieces. And then it evolved, and when schools and groups started making monks, it became the robe that the monks wore. Ordinary people didn't, but the monks did. And then it became something very special, and it was made out of beautiful fabric. And it had different colors according to the ranks of the monks. And it was becoming farther and farther away from the spirit of making a piece of clothing with donated material. The Japanese, by the time it reached Japan, it was the Chinese who originated this. By the time these teachings went from India to China, centuries and centuries and centuries later, reduced it to this, to just a small object that could easily be taken on and off, and could be worn with anything else. Keeping the spirit without bringing the spirit into the context in which they lived and functioned. And then in Japan, basically the same thing applied, but they also had the special robes for the monks. And at some times during the day, the monks would use this instead of the other robe. When they were working, for example, because the special robe was very special, and they couldn't sit on it, for example, and it couldn't touch the ground, and all sorts of special rules. So they used this instead. All of it just as a symbol of the original source of awakening. Awaken, just as a reminder to be here now, let's say, of what the original teachings were. Now, in the West, in the first wave, there were a lot of monks still. And a lot of Westerners became monks and had special robes. And they also had these. And then people who weren't monks, there was a ritual developed for them in which they would receive this as a symbol of the same thing. That their life was the practice and the practice was their life. Now I am the third generation in the West, and we don't have any monks anymore, or priests. Everyone is the same, in that sense. However, if someone wants to engage and recognize that their life is the practice and the practice is their life, we have a ritual, as I said yesterday, in this rite of passage, during which they receive this. But they make this themselves. And it's a whole process. It's a very intricate object to make. It's little pieces of cloth sewn together. And in a very, it's very Japanese in that sense. It's very beautiful and delicate and put together in a very ingenious way. And then on the back, the teacher writes something. Writes the name, the student or the disciple's real name, the name their parents gave them, and then a name that the teacher gives them, and writes the teacher's name, the one that the teacher was given by the parents, and the name that the teacher was given by her or his teacher, and puts her stamp on it, and then writes something. Initially, what is written in our tradition is a verse that comes from the monastic practice, but also applies to all of us. So that is written on the back of the new rakusu. This is called a rakusu that the people have made and that they will receive during the ceremony tomorrow. Then, usually they are black, like Sophie's. The ones that they make are black. Then, when I became a teacher, my teacher gave me a different one. Actually, she gave me a different one, the other one that I've been wearing, which is very dark purple. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it looks purple, sometimes it looks black, sometimes it looks blue. I like that, you can't tell. And then, a few years later, she gave me this one, which I really didn't want to wear. It was far too flashy and too bright and too different from everyone else, but she gave it to me, and she wrote a beautiful thing on the back of it, and I had to let go of my ideas about flashy, different, too important, too brilliant or something. And so I wear it. And I don't really think about it too much. In fact, yesterday I forgot it. But then Claudia went and got it during the walking meditation, and I had the scarf on, so no one knew that I didn't have it. So that's what it is. It for me, my personal relationship with it is that it serves as a reminder. So whenever I'm in a practice, you know, formal practice setting or teaching situation, or I'm giving a conference or meeting people in some way in which I am seen as a teacher, I wear it for myself. And it also says something to other people. I don't know what it says to everyone, but it says something, because it's not an ordinary object. I also have... I was trained by my teacher in a context very different from this, where we wore the Zen robes, the black robes, and the teachers had the special robe that came from the monks' tradition, and so I received that when I became a teacher. But I don't know how to wear it. I don't know how to put it on. And I use it only if the situation calls for it. Which is really only for very formal situations when I'm with my teacher, basically. Traditionally, in the ceremony tomorrow, I should be wearing it. It's considered the robe of the Buddha, and in my capacity tomorrow, I am sitting in the position of the Buddha, and I should be wearing it. But I don't interpret the tradition in that way, in terms of forms. What interests me and what speaks to me is to go to the source of this tradition. What is the origin? What is the real meaning? And then apply it in the context that means something for us here. So I don't wear any robes, anything except this.
Can you tell us what it says?
Ah, yes. Good point. Very good point. It says... When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that is wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. Between these two, my life turns. And this is a quote from Nisargadatta, who was not a Zen teacher officially, He's from the Vedantist tradition in India. But that statement tells us everything about Zen teaching and practice. When I look inside and see that I'm nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I'm everything, that's love or compassion, we could say. Between these two, my life turns. This fits with what we were saying yesterday about the three views, the three perspectives. It also fits with another trilogy that I like to use, which I use in my practice as an artist, and which I'm a poet, and which I use in the practice of what I call Zen art, which is the sky, which would be the equivalent of looking inside and I am nothing. There is nothing. The earth, which is the equivalent of looking outside and seeing everything. The earth is abundant with everything, with things. Endless phenomena. And the third in this trilogy of the art is the human being, which is between the sky and the earth, my life turns. I serve as the bridge between the two. The two are manifested in me, in my life. The sky is the wisdom, the absolute, seeing the absolute perfection of everything. Several people in the interviews have come in and said, you know, that I said this, I said that, and I said, several people have said something about, you know, life is perfect, everything is perfect. And I'm surprised because I didn't hear myself say that yesterday. But clearly I did, because that's what people received. That's very important. However, there is also the earth, which is not perfect. It's perfect, but it's perfectly imperfect. Things die here. Things are born here. There are tsunamis that wash away, wash up onto the land. The earth moves and causes great destruction. It's ruthless. The earth is ruthless. And yet, oh, the flowers are amazing. The terrible dark storm clouds are beautiful. All of these differences. So there is the absolute, empty, perfect blue sky, like today. And then there is this wild, chaotic, impossible, out of control earth. And in between, here we are.
I find it interesting that this trilogy is forming many, many traditions
everywhere.
One in particular, like you're talking now, and my heart is really from the heart. And one I particularly like is within the ourselves, there's also this trilogy manifested. And you have, for example, the Taoists, for example, you also have the Sufis, they're the same. We have three main centers in the body. So one is in the abdomen, lower abdomen, another one in the heart, another one in the head. So, and the head is connected to the unmanifested, to the sky, the abdomen is connected to the earth, you know, reproduction, being born, and stuff like this. And the heart is in the middle where the soul of the mind lies. And so it's in between the two. And when we realize, we have this realization when these two come together in the heart. So, the soul of the mind.
Absolutely.
It's an image I like.
Also, found in psychoanalysis.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. Everywhere you look. It's everywhere. In the church. The Trinity. Everywhere. Literature. My big work these days, as for years and years, but it's coming to fruition, is the Ulysses of James Joyce. Trilogy. Three parts. Everywhere. And the key is to how then, as human beings, do we manifest this? We are manifesting it. You know, in the Zen art process, we, as he says, we there's an exercise we do where we feel that we are through our head, the top of our head, connected to the sky, and through our feet, and through our lower body. To the earth, and then how do we manifest it? How do we manifest these apparently opposite, dualistic concepts, realities? As I was saying yesterday, there's the reality of the personal and the reality of the impersonal. There's the reality of the literal, the reality of the subjective. How do we manifest this? That's what this says. Between these two, my life turns. There is no other place for life. That's where it happens. If we are constantly longing for the sky, this perfectly empty sky, which is a very common longing, we want everything gone. We want no worries. We want everybody out of our face. We don't want to think about money. We don't want to think about relationships. We don't want to think about food. Nothing. Trouble. Life can't happen that way. If, on the other hand, we indulge in the wild, chaotic, material world, if we pay no attention to the empty sky, which our culture, our modern world, tends to do, mass communication, mass consumption, accumulation, even the notion of individuals, no connections between people, or only virtual connections. I have a lot of friends, but I don't know any of them. Sometimes I don't have Facebook, but my son does, and sometimes he says, "Oh yes, I have that person as a friend on Facebook." So, oh, really, do you know him? No. So, fine. There are a lot of connections. But do we really, are we really connected? Are we really relating? So, here we are. How do we do it? It's what I said yesterday about how do we manifest? How do we live? And the master, if we call it that, is just someone who is asking that question and to the best of their ability attempting to answer it in their life. And offering the opportunity to others to come along and do the same thing. Part of this, the loud noise, in the article that I read when they said it was to symbolize that you are alone, that we are alone, in fact, it may be the opposite. It may be, as in the version that Christina recounted, you're not alone. You're alone, but with others. So we are all here. We are all alone. We are all individual. We are all ourself. But we are together. That. And again, this community, what we call the Sangha, is in the trilogy, in the Buddhist version of the trilogy, you have the Buddha, you have the Dharma, and you have the Sangha. And these are called the three treasures. They just represent the three aspects of this trilogy. The Buddha representing the sky, the emptiness. The Dharma representing what we call the 10,000 things, the unlimited number, the numberless phenomena, beings, things, actions, reactions. And the Sangha representing, the Sangha being community, representing the harmony or the interaction of the two. It's in the Sangha where the sky and the earth come together, in the interrelationships, in the individual personal beings coming together as one in the impersonal. And while in the Sangha, there is the Buddha aspect, everyone is oneness. No individuals. No one separate. There is also the Dharma aspect, the diversity. Each of us is different, and we each have a different place in the Sangha. But each of those places are equally important. So the place that I happen to fill is here. I don't always like this place, but I acknowledge that this is my place, and I accept to take that place. I always have to sit in the same place. You can move around. In the meals, I always have to sit in the same place. You can pick another place to sit, but I have to sit in that one place. I always have to sit here in front of that statue. You can sit somewhere else. It's okay. And I suppose I could say, no, I'm not going to sit here. That's my choice, I suppose, right? But I recognize that it's important for someone to sit here. It's important for someone to fill this place. I know because I've been there, and I know how important it was for me in my practice to have someone sitting here. And everyone is sitting exactly in their place, and that place is as important as this place. It has a different function, but it has the same importance. So the community, the Sangha, like the human being, so the human being, I guess, could be the micro level, where we represent this trilogy, we manifest this trilogy. And the Sangha being the macro level, where the trilogy, the Trinity, is manifest. And then we have the same thing in the greater world. And we have the same thing in a relationship with two people. And we have the same thing in a plant and everywhere. Everything manifests this. I don't know where I got off on that tangent, but I'm sure there was a reason. How much time do we have?
20 minutes.
I brought this because I wanted to use a tell a Zen story. Or two. So maybe I will. That's the end of our talk. Which relates to the idea of the master. And I say the idea because it's an idea that we have. This is a story we call these koans in Japanese or Chinese Zen. They're just little stories or anecdotes or phrases that come from the collective experience and that we have kept as tools to work with students and as teaching examples to help us break through our thoughts and our ideas and our opinions and our usual ways of thinking of our intellect, how we get caught by our intellect. And this one is about, involves the person, the man who brought the Buddhist teachings from India to China. And his name was Bodhidharma. And he apparently was a prince in India, but left all of that and went to study with a teacher, practice, like us. And then his teacher sent him off, and he chose to go to India, to China, to bring these teachings to China. And this story occurs, he's been in China for some time. He had gained some fame. The emperor had heard about him. He went before the emperor. It wasn't a very successful encounter. The emperor didn't like what he said. And so Bodhidharma left and went off and lived in a cave or off in the mountains by himself. But he had become quite well known, and people who were seeking had heard of him and were seeking him out. He had become well known because he said that this practice, these teachings, had nothing to do with scriptures, holy texts, words of any sort. They pointed directly to the heart. And aimed at awakening our true nature. And this was very unusual at the time. In China, no one had heard this before. And so he had gained some fame. So in this story, he's off by himself in the mountains, and someone comes to see him, someone who has heard about him, and has made a long, long journey to come and see him. And Bodhidharma doesn't receive him. He sits in his hut or his cave or wherever it was. And the seeker, is left outside. And waits outside and waits and waits and waits. And Bodhidharma doesn't come. So in this story it says, Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. This has become a popular notion of what Bodhidharma does, faces the wall. But all it means is that he is facing the wall of reality. He's not turning his face away from what is before him. And it's impenetrable. It's just what it is. And he's sitting there facing that. And this other person arrives, and it's snowing a lot. So he's standing in the snow, desperate, so desperate, the story says, that he cuts off his arm to show Bodhidharma how determined he is. And he says to Bodhidharma, bringing him his arm, your disciple's mind is not yet at peace. I beg you, my teacher, please give it peace. So he's coming and he's saying, I'm not at peace. Please, please, please put my mind at peace. And Bodhidharma says, bring your mind to me, and I will set it at rest. So everyone's laughing. But this is a serious question. This is a serious issue. How many of you here could say you're at peace? And how many of you could say that you wouldn't really like to have someone else put you at peace? It would be really nice, wouldn't it? And he's been standing, he's, you know, made a long trip, and he's climbed a mountain, and this is the proverbial getting to the mountaintop, facing the master. And the guy doesn't even acknowledge him. And he stands there in the snow. And finally he's desperate and he cuts off his arm. This is how badly he wants it. He wants to be at peace. And the guy says, bring me your mind and I'll put it at peace. Well, okay. So he goes off. The disciple goes off and, okay, bring him my mind so he can put it at peace. After some time, it doesn't say how long, he comes back and he says, I have searched for my mind everywhere and finally it is unattainable. I can't find it. And Bodhidharma says, I have thoroughly set it at rest for you. I have put your mind at peace for you. So what happens here? He wants to be at peace. He wants his mind. His mind is troubled. He's desperate. It's already important that he has realized that his mind is restless and he's not at peace and there's something not right. He wants something different. That's important. He makes the journey. That's important. He realizes he needs help. He's opened to the possibility. He trusts his desire. Even though the teacher doesn't come out, he trusts it. He doesn't know how to do it, but he trusts that he wants it. He cuts off his arm. We have to take these stories too as we could say he's letting go of some important aspect of himself. This is symbolizing dropping something that's important to him. Letting go of, it's the equivalent of bowing, we could say. We drop it. We drop that, our identity for a moment. And finally, Bodhidharma says, okay, bring me your mind and I'll put it to rest for you. He's directing the student to keep looking. Mm-hmm. He's not giving him an answer. He's saying, keep looking. It helps to have someone tell you that. It helps to have someone, it's like the plant with the tutor. It's with the stick that's holding it up. It helps to have someone standing there with you, giving you an indication. So he says, okay. He feels like he's been heard and he will do it. When I met my teacher, I wanted to repeat a very powerful experience that I had had. I wanted it to happen again, and again, and again, and again. So I went to her and I wanted her to tell me, okay, do it again. But she didn't say that. She said, I think it would be better if you just sat down and just sat there, stabilize a bit what you experienced, sit on the earth. Forget about the sky a little bit, sit on the earth. She didn't use those words, but that was the message. And I did it. I said, okay. That's exactly what I needed. And I said, okay. Just like he says, okay. He's desperate, he's looking so hard and he wants the answer, and the guy says, go look some more. Okay. So he does. And he comes back and he says, I've looked everywhere. I can't find it anywhere. And although Bodhidharma says, I have set your mind at rest for you, we all know that's not true. Bodhidharma knows it, and Eka, who became his successor, knows it. And there's a little poem that goes with this story. It says, coming from the west and directly pointing, so Bodhidharma comes from the west, India is west of China, and points directly to the heart, this great affair was caused by the transmission. So he came from the West and he pointed because he wanted to transmit this. He wanted to show other people that it was possible. And what did he show? And he was considered a kind of a dissident, a rebel. So the troublemaker, it says here. The troublemaker who created a stir in Zen circles, so he created all these troubles, is, after all, you.